The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. I want to start this week's show by acknowledging a couple of errors I've made. Just a couple of them. They're recent. I've made more errors and committed more wrongs than I could possibly list in just this half an hour. I have many amends to make and much for which to atone. And don't worry, we're not going to list them all right now. Just two things, really. First, it's an apology for mispronouncing a name. I got it quite wrong. A few weeks back, we had audio from a presentation by the founder of Teenergizer, whose name is Yana Panfilova. I was in a rush. I was too close to deadline. I screwed up. There is no excuse. I am sorry. The other error for which I'm now apologizing actually has to do with my day job, but it's also pertinent to today's show. Loyal listeners may recall that I compile and edit a resource called Drug Policy Facts. It's a large resource, always expanding, covers all kinds of topics related to drug policies. Yet until recently, we did not have a section on image and performance-enhancing drugs. No reason, just a foolish oversight, really. And we've been around since 1998, so it's rather embarrassing that it took 25 years. But I did finally correct this. The need for a drug policy facts section on image and performance-enhancing drugs was driven home to me by a presentation they attended recently, given by Dr. Tim Piankowski. Dr. Timothy Piankowski is an early career researcher and lecturer in applied psychology at Griffith University within the School of Applied Psychology within the Center for Mental Health and the Health and Psychology Research Innovations Laboratory.
When we speak about performance enhancing drugs, or PIEDs or PEDs, oftentimes people just think of steroids, anabolic steroids. And I just wanted to add some nuance to this and explain a little bit more before we continue to move and discuss this more fully. So along the top here, I've got a number of categories, and this AAS refers to anabolic androgenic steroids. So that's things like testosterone or stanozolol. And consumers will use these steroids in generally what's called a cycle. So 10 weeks of use followed by 10 weeks of non-use. More commonly and more recently, consumers will do what's called blasting and cruising. So they'll use testosterone at a lower dosage for a longer period of time, say for a year or two. And in between that, whenever a competition comes up or perhaps a music festival, they will blast and they will add in a higher dosage, add in a number of other compounds and so on and so forth, and then return back to a cruising dose. During this time, they will use ancillary compounds. So these are used in post-cycle therapy. So when we want to restore hormonal balance, so things like clomiphene, tamoxifen, or other restoration drugs. They'll also be used on-cycle or on these blasting cruises when things arise. So perhaps there's too much estrogen aromatizing and there's some male breast growth going on. So they'll turn to these aromatase inhibitors to assist with that. Also during this time, there's other hormones and drugs which are being used, quite commonly stacked. So human growth hormone, insulin, thyroid hormones, prohormones, more recently SARMs have come up more and more and more, or peptides like growth hormone releasing peptides. And this is just to give you an idea of the breadth and depth of this category of substances. When we think about steroids, anabolic androgenic steroids, often they're lumped in as just this one thing, right? And as I spoke about earlier, we have injectable and oral derivatives. Now, this is just to give you an idea. We've got a number of different testosterones down this left-hand side here. These are oils that are injected intramuscularly. We've got other categories like 19-nor testosterone. So these are drugs like nandrolone and trenbolone. We've also got DHT derivatives, so drugs like drostanolone. I'd like you to remember these different categories as we move through this presentation because they'll come up again. Just want you to remember that particularly this 19-nor testosterone category. We've also got oral derivatives of steroids. So these are methylated and have to pass through the liver twice. They're quite harsh on the liver, as well as these DHT derivatives. And again, these prohormones and other PIEDs, so insulin, growth hormone, Superdrol, things like that. And oftentimes when we talk about steroids or we talk about PEDs, people just think that it's this one thing, this one pill or this one oil that people inject and that's it. And as we go through today's presentation, I really want you to think about the nuances and the differences here as I speak to that and how important these differences are to consider. In terms of prevalence or the size of this problem, I draw on a few different pieces of data now. So we turn to the NDSHS data. According to 2019, only about 0.8% of people over the age of 14 have reported use of steroids. This could be unlikely or slightly inaccurate for a variety of reasons that the people that use these substances aren't likely to have completed the survey. However, I do want to draw your attention to the fact that there was a significant difference in an increase from 2016 to 2019 of people using these substances. And that there's been a consistent increase since 2001 of people using these substances. In terms of the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, we can see on the right-hand side here that these substance consumers, these drug injectors, are represented in populations. They do exist and they've held a fairly stable percentage of the cohort for quite some time. From needle service provider data then, because these people need to get their equipment somewhere. Among new initiates to injection, one in four last reported injecting PIEDs. Notably, the volume of equipment taken by these clients is generally higher than other NSP clients, so those who use intravenously methamphetamine, for example, again, because of that cyclic nature that I spoke about earlier, you know, 10 weeks of perhaps every other day injections adds up quite significantly. And so NSP staff don't see these clientele as often. There's also other difficulties like peer distribution. This client group don't see themselves as drug users necessarily. And so they might send their partner in to collect their needles or distribute them through peers. And in Australia in particular, we're facing a workforce that has identified itself that it's got significant gaps in knowledge for this particular cohort. And so when we consider traditional harm reduction responses to injecting drug use, the health effects of steroids are generally outside of the focus. And it's very apparent in the following ways. The fact that we have a lack of health service access among this consumer group due to stigmatization, but also the perceived lack of knowledge from healthcare providers about steroids. And consumers then report finding it very challenging, very difficult to justify attending these health clinics when they don't feel that the professional has the adequate information and they're not open to learning. And then they really just don't get any care at all and engage in more use or perhaps at least don't cease use. When we speak about the harms of these drugs or of these substances, I can't give you a number like with opioid overdose. I can't say this many people a day die from PED use. And so it's quite challenging to quantify the economic burden of harm or to give you a figure. And so I've turned to two very, very realistic case studies, one less recent and one quite a bit more recent. So I'm sure some of you might have heard of Aziz, Aziz Shavershian, in 2011, died in a sauna in Thailand, was described as a healthy lifestyle freak, a bodybuilder. Aziz frequented a number of bodybuilding forums. He used a number of different compounds. And I think that if we ignore the fact that there was some sort of interaction or contribution there, then we'd be lying. In terms of more recently, we've got German bodybuilder Joe Lindner, who died at the age of 30. And he, Joe Aesthetic was his Instagram handle. He had a massive following, micro-celebrity status, with the cause of death being an aneurysm. Now, just a few days before his death, he had posted about the health issues that he was experiencing from his testosterone replacement therapy, and I'd hazard a guess that it was a little bit more than testosterone replacement therapy that he was using. But if, again, we ignore this connection of harms, probably being a little bit short-sighted. And these aren't isolated cases. This isn't just happening here. And this is happening. There's only some media attention being brought when it's, a micro-celebrity or an influencer. And there's certainly other harms which can arise from these substances as well. And so when we look at substance consumption frameworks or traditional frameworks, psychopharmacological paradigms tell us that, you know, notions of addiction and dependency perpetuate this belief that drug users are entrapped by these metaphorical demons, or they're under possession of the drug, or that they're psychologically damaged, and then they turn to the drugs to resolve that. So when we look at the frameworks of the substance consumer, then in this context, drug consumers looked at as passive and socially isolated individuals. Their sense of self is controlled by the substance. And that's often been applied to steroid consumers in these contexts of public media, right? The emphasis has been put on the substance itself rather than the other social factors that influence the consumption. And we don't look at the agency of the user or the cultural significance that they assign to the use. And this limitation generally stems from the outsider's perspective failing to consider the context of the drug use and that nuanced dual meaning that it holds for the consumer. I know, you know, Cameron Duff has written about this quite a lot. Then I pose to you in terms of steroid consumer frameworks. The socio-cultural trajectory of steroids exemplifies this fluid transfer of substances across various individuals, as you can see on the right-hand side here, from high-level Brazilian jiu-jitsu athletes, from micro-celebrities like Liver King or influencers like Ziz. There's various contexts and purposes for the use. Significance is attributed to these substances, not necessarily because of the inherent property, but because of the subjective evaluation that's made by the individual. Is it performance, image enhancing, combination of both? And so some of my earlier research around social identity and group norms has identified that there's some crucial factors influencing, that these are crucial factors influencing particularly men's initiation and the persistence of steroid use in Australia. Now, echoing some of Cohen's perspectives and work on methamphetamine use, the consumption of steroids in Australia might exhibit some similarities. It's not necessarily an act of deviance, but perhaps it's a response to growing societal expectations, as we can see on the right-hand side here. In Queensland particularly, we have sun, we have beaches, we have music festivals, had music festivals. And so this might have lent itself to particular behaviours, steroid consumption use being one of them. And so in this context, steroid consumption might be understood as a means of just meeting heightened demands imposed by society. Certainly on social media, we see these beautiful bodies posted, and they're very much in the face of young people. And if we're ignoring the fact that that's having an influence on them, it's very short-sighted to consider that the people wouldn't turn to steroids to meet those expectations. And so globally, in terms of steroids, there's other factors to consider, however. There's a lack of dedicated harm reduction framework for steroid use in Australia, and part of this might stem from the criminalisation of these substances. So consumers turn to each other for advice, again, with the peer lived experience, not just distribution of sharps, but of information as well. I'll note that even in the UK, where they operate under a Class C framework where personal possession of steroids is legal, many users still remain secretive in response to the stigma fueled by mainstream media. And so in an Australian context where we deal with use punitively, that stigma is compounded by harsh laws and policies that surround steroids. I want to note that here in Australia, we've had an increase of 218% of steroid-related arrests over the last decade, so up to over 1,000 in 2020. And the number of steroid detections at the Australian border has been very, very stable over the same decade, only increasing about 1%. So still lots of seizures. Now, the other time point that I want to make, want to draw attention to is that since 2014, Queensland in particular has brought in punitive measures whereby steroids are categorised as a Schedule 1 drug. So they, like heroin and methamphetamine, attract up to 25 years in prison for possession. And there's similarly stringent penalties enforced in New South Wales, if we think of one-punch laws, and the links there, as well as Victoria, and that reinforces the gravity that we treat these offences with.
That was Dr. Tim Piontkowski, a nearly career researcher and lecturer in applied psychology at Griffith University within the School of Applied Psychology within the Center for Mental Health and the Health and Psychology Research Innovations Laboratory. He spoke August 17th in a webinar entitled Redefining Harm Reduction and Rethinking Policy for Performance and Image-Enhancing Drug Consumers, which was held by Australia's National Drug and Alcohol Research Center. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear more from Dr. Piontkowski about redefining harm reduction and rethinking policy for performance and image-enhancing drug consumers.
When we speak about harm reduction, or how, when I want to speak about how we redefine harm reduction for this unique cohort, then I want to draw everyone's attention to the fact that these outcomes, this fear, the result of the social lives of steroids rather than the harmful pharmaceutical effects, although I completely acknowledge that these are also present. But some of the harms emanate from this political landscape of regulation that we have rather than the individual's risky behaviours, and that political landscape also compounds some of the problems. And so this problematic reliance on peers speaks to the politicogenic effects of pushing users into insular, non-cooperating communities. And we've seen this happening for quite some time now, for many decades actually, with AAS, with steroid consumers and PED consumers. It's an issue with trust. There's an issue with rapport. There's an issue with engagement. And so how can public health messaging and relevant education initiatives for healthcare providers hit their mark, hit their target, when they're constantly being undermined by alternative ethico-legal frameworks that have no alignment necessarily? And so without addressing these elements regarding illegal behaviours and providing some clear direction, steroid consumers continue to be left afraid and unprepared, and the workforce that is meant to be serving them is left unequipped to assist. In Queensland, we accounted for over 50% of the national steroid arrests, and that was followed by Western Australia, New South Wales and Victoria. And in Australia, we've got an average of 45,000 offenders detected with the principal offence of use possession of a drug each year. Now, 55% of them are diverted by police, but again, we've got no specific drug diversion programs for steroid and PIED consumers. So I'd advocate that perhaps specifically targeted programs might ensure a more equitable representation for this unique group of substance consumers. And again, particularly in Queensland, we've got the unofficial moniker of Australia's steroid capital. Perhaps this unique group is really requiring a little bit more acknowledgement and a little bit further research at this intersection of criminogenic needs, responsivity, and harm reduction. I've been speaking about lived experience and peers and that nature, and there's definitely many good harm reduction properties and mechanisms that come about from that. However, one other interesting thing that came out from this piece of work and from other research that I've done is this double-edged nature of peers. So for PID users, for steroid users, trusted pathways definitely include peers, and these peers are suppliers, work colleagues, friends. Also, I want to highlight that harm reduction workers from NSPs are very, very highly regarded among this group, especially compared to other healthcare providers like GPs. So one quote from a participant, definitely peers, my coach, I use a lot of his mind. I reckon peers because I just know so many people who have been doing this for 10 or more years And then I think that kind of builds a trust. They know what they're doing by now, if that makes sense. And so that's fantastic if the right information is being propagated. But peers can also propagate myths. And so we come back to the table that I showed you at the start, come back to this 19 more testosterone category, and we come back to a compound, a type of steroid called trenbolone. And trenbolone was originally used for livestock. It was used to increase appetite and stimulate muscle growth. It says for heifers. Injectable trenbolone was first used by or adapted by bodybuilders from dissolving what was called Thinaplex pellets. And then we have this compound that has become commonly known to consumers as tren. I'll note as well here that tren, in terms of neurotoxicity, in terms of harms and harshness, is significantly more harsh from a physiological perspective as well. However, from a psychosocial perspective, there are also harms. So, as I said earlier, quite commonly steroids are lumped together, but there are potentially very, very different risk profiles, and these are seldom discussed, although recent ethnographic research has identified the need to do so. Myth is developed among users of trenbolone or users of steroids considering to use trenbolone, or non-users just considering initiating use, that there's a more dramatic effect on individuals. And these include reports of aggression, violent behavior, and extreme mood disturbances. And so in another set of interviews with steroid consumers, trenbolone emerged and was represented in this way. And so in these set of interviews, 16 consumers mentioned trenbolone and mentioned the role it played in their lives. And we interrogated that a little bit further as it was a semi-structured setting. So had 16 participants, and they had a mean age of about 30, relatively even distribution of males and females. And 8 participants had used trenbolone at least once in their lives, although all participants had encountered it through experiences of peers using it. There's some participant specifics on the right-hand side there. Interviews went for about 50 minutes and were thematically analysed. Again, around this central narrative of, well, what is trend's contribution? How do you understand trend to fit within the harm profile? And what are the differences? And so this narrative emerged about these harms which accompanied steroid use, but tren was central to that. Of all the steroids, trenbolone was viewed as having the most deleterious consequences for those who used it. And I'll let you read the quote on the top by yourselves, as that's from a tren user, tren consumer. This second quote is from a steroid-using peer, however, a non-trend user. They keep using, but as a consequence of that, they might destroy their relationships or make silly decisions. Maybe someone who wasn't using trend would have thought twice about and gone, maybe this isn't the best decision. Users reported an extreme shift in their risk profile for psychosocial harms, particularly around aggression, violent behaviour and impulse regulation. And I'll let you read this quote from a trenbolone user on your own again. But I want to draw attention to the fact that this was very, very separate from when we speak about aggression or anything generated from steroids. Or perhaps when we speak about that, we simply never in the literature or in the public eye captured these differences. And trenbolone has always been sitting there for quite some time without adequate understanding. And so these shifts and these reports were also readily observable by people who weren't using trenbolone but knew that their peers were or that other people were. And so trenbolone might have a very significant role in contributing to the instances of psychosocial harm, especially violent behaviour, And that's the reason these policies existed in the first place, particularly if we think about one-punch laws and links between steroids and violence and alcohol. And so there might be a potential here to separate specific steroids into separate classes, depending on the level of harm to the community. I have some pictures on the top right here from some personal professional networks from a manufacturer of steroids. And this really doesn't look too different than these crystals and powders here when we speak about methamphetamine. So similar to these previous distinctions between different forms of methamphetamine powder versus crystal, we had associated conceptualizations around the harms which emerged there. I think there's definitely some parallels here that can be drawn. And so when it comes to this element of today's presentation around rethinking policy, I'll draw your attention to the fact that some users had sworn off trenbolone. They said, I wouldn't use it again because X, Y, Z, as you saw in the quote. Instead, they opt for DHT derivatives, these ones on the right-hand side here, and they believe that these are less harsh in their physical and psychological health. And so if we interpret this, if we listen to the consumers, if we follow the lived experience appropriately, then this could lead to an organic alignment of drug policy in Australia. The fact that, if you think back to the table again, the fact that, yes, perhaps 19 more testosterones belong in a Schedule 1 category, which is associated with the harms to the consumer and to the community. But perhaps other types of anabolic androgenic steroids, like injectable testosterone, like dihydrotestosterone derivatives, like methylated orals, may be reconsidered in terms of scheduling. Also, the fact that there's no research in this space specifically around prohormones or other PIEDs around Subidrol, insulin, human growth hormone, there's definitely a need for further research there. And I do want to highlight that further projects exploring this area are sorely needed. And I currently have one underway, but I think there's definitely room and need for more.
That was Dr. Tim Piotkowski, an early career researcher and lecturer in applied psychology at Griffith University within the School of Applied Psychology within the Center for Mental Health and the Health and Psychology Research Innovations Laboratory. He spoke August 17th in a webinar entitled Redefining Harm Reduction and Rethinking Policy for Performance and Image-Enhancing Drug Consumers that was held by Australia's National Drug and Alcohol Research Center. NDARC will hold its 2023 Research Symposium on Friday, October 27th. This is a free event. Main sessions will be live streamed. Additional breakout sessions will also be made available online. So even if you don't happen to live in or near Sydney, you can attend. The main program is up on the NDARC website. Do check it out. You can find NDARC at ndarc.med.unsw.edu.au. That's too much of a mouthful, so just search for Australia's National Drug and Alcohol Research Center, NDARC. You'll find it. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.